Hey, Zero Block 30 listeners, you can find us every Tuesday and Friday on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube. Prime members can also listen ad-free on Amazon Music.
Are you looking for relief, relaxation, or to party on the motherfucking moon? Then check out 3Chi's new True Strains lineup of cannabis vapes and gummies tailored for specific effects. And the best part? It's delivered straight to your door. Visit 3Chi.com. That's 3CHI.com. And for a limited time, get 20% off with the code BARSTOOL20.
On today's episode of Zero Block 30, we are going to have five rounds in the magazine. The round number one, a jury acquits a senior NCO accused of pointing a gun at a soldier, calling another one fat, and some racial remarks thrown in there as well. Round number two, the Battle of Peleliu, Eugene Sledge, in his own words about what that battle is. We're going to delve into a little bit of Zero Block history. Round number three, female first. Woo-hoo! This past week, we had the first female Marine to graduate from the arduous Winter Mountain Leaders Course and the first female test pilot to lead an Air Force F-35 mission. Round number four, Army and Marines train together to fight underground in mega cities. Not as important as Megacoda, but mega cities are big too. Shout out Megacoda. Round number five, safety brief for Kate's trip to Nolens.
I'm going to jail.
And let's just say this. If you want to be a dude who has any shot, and Catherine, correct me if I'm wrong, if you're any dude who wants to have a shot with Catherine, you better not need a no-shave chit. You better be clean-shaven, have your one white Charlies, and brush your nasty little fangs. All of that you could do. Am I right, Kate?
Completely. I'm not about that rug burn life.
There we go. All of that can be done through with our friends at Dollar Shave Club. Dollar Shave Club has everything that you need to feel and look and smell your best. That's why I have them. Dollar Shave Club has everything you need to get ready, no matter what you're getting ready for. If you're going to a dance recital, if you're going to the play, if you're going to a playoff game, whatever. They have it all. They have this toothpaste that smells wonderful and it's delicious. I like it a lot. It's peppermint and it lasts. The flavor stays in your mouth for a long time. Plus, they have a handsome discount. The more that you buy, the more that you save. And right now, they have a bunch of their starter kits for just $5, like their oral care kit. After that, you can restock the boxes. And fellas, even if you don't like using body wash on your body, because I know some dudes just like bar soap, this stuff makes fantastic bubble bath. They have one that smells like cedar. You smell like a man in the luxury of bubble bath, which I don't think it gets any better than that. Go to dollarshaveclub.com/chaps. That's dollarshaveclub.com/chaps to get going on that. And ladies, you could shave your vagina with their razors too. That was probably too much. Ghost, Kate, and Cons. We got Bren here as well. He is our lovely producer. All right, so the first story that we want to get into revolves around a senior NCO who was acquitted of pointing a gun at a soldier, which I think, spoiler alert, she was acquitted. We had that in the title. But there's a lot of things that are going on with this case. Claim number one is that two soldiers were saying that Barboza pointed a 9mm pistol at one of them during weapons training, which she said wasn't true.
Yes, as her defense, I would like to say that he lied about Barboza pointing the 9mm, mostly out of spite, because she had let other soldiers go on temporary duties instead of him, and because he was spending too much time with the other woman who claimed she saw it, whom Barboza called fat.
Why the Southern accent there, Kate? We just...
I'm a fancy Southern lawyer, but these are actually the defense. I am reading what the defense said, but okay. I'm being a fancy Southern lawyer.
Okay, Kate's claim number two.
Jesus.
Barboza humiliated another soldier by repeating calling her fat.
Yes, Barboza did call the other soldier fat, saying, "My intention was to motivate her and also let her know I was concerned."
And claim number three, Barboza touching the hair of an African-American staff sergeant without her permission and then calling it, quote, nasty, and using the term, I hate even saying this on the pod.
I'm glad you're saying it, not me.
I mean, it's part of it, nigritus, referring to female African-American soldiers.
Well, Barboza said she was only getting a piece of paper out of the African-American soldier's hair. And yes, she did call a female African-American soldier's negritas, but said it was a term of affection meaning little black girl in her Mexican-American SoCal culture.
All right. Well, she was found not guilty of dereliction of duty, maltreatment, and disrespecting an NCO by a panel of 9 male officers and senior NCOs. At least 6 of them had to agree to acquit. The court martial had begun after she refused to accept NJP, which in a lot of times, I think refusing NJP is the smart thing to do. If you're an active duty person, your command does not want you to do it. And I would guess there's a good portion of things that you'll get NJP'd for that go away if you don't accept an NJP, because they don't want to take it to court martial, because the standard of proving somebody's guilt at court martial is just so much higher than NJP. Mm-hmm. NJP commanding officer just has absolute complete discretion. You're innocent, you're guilty. It's a trial of one instead of a trial of 9, which if you're smart, unless you're absolutely guilty and they got you dead to rights, don't just accept NJP. That's my staff and CO advice of the day. Barboza said this is my favorite part of this entire story. She said the entire thing was a learning experience, and I guess my gung-ho-ness just got in the way. It taught me to be a little bit more sensitive. Pointing a gun at somebody is not being gung-ho.
No. That's wrong.
Phrase means.
They're saying she didn't do it, but also there was a part that the defense, like her defense, was like, the other person who saw it totally misinterpreted it. And I'm like, how do you misinterpret someone pointing a gun? At the same time, though, they said from the time they charged her with NJP to the court martial, it was over a year. So, like, I feel like your memory, we've talked about this before, but
things
change over that much time. So I can see that going in her favor. And I had a question, too. My other thought on this, I feel like even if it's a term of affection in the culture you come from, you know better. I'm sorry. You're calling soldier, not negritas or little black girl or anything like that. To me, that was,
if you are using it as your culture dictates, it's little black girl. Like, these are grown ass women.
Right.
You're not a little anything girl. Like, you're a staff sergeant in the army.
Right, and not to mention how you talk back on the block is not necessarily how you should be speaking in a professional setting. And when you're speaking in a work environment to someone within your unit, that is most definitely a professional environment. You shouldn't be using terms that you would just be using with your buddies. I don't care. You're saying it's okay because that's how I talk to my friends back home. That is not a valid defense at all.
And I say all that knowing full and well that I referred to my Marines primarily as my little bitches. That was my go-to phrase. You little bitch.
But see, that's a blanket term. That's not narrowing out one specific.
Yeah.
If I did that just to female Marines I worked with, I'd probably gotten in trouble. But right. Definitely. Everybody, no matter what color, no matter what gender you are, I'd be like, come here, bitch. I think I'm totally fine. And in fact, some would say that I was being sexist if I didn't say it to women. Because I admit.
Totally.
Chaps, progressive, way back then. That's
unbelievably. Chaps, hell yeah.
Unbelievably progressive, wow.
Well, either way, she's off on all counts, so whatever.
But what do you do? I mean, the thing about this type of situation is, in reality, her career still is going to suffer greatly. Because whenever she goes for promotion boards, they're going to know that she had these charges, that she had been court-martialed before. All that stuff's in her record book. So when they go look at EA E9 for her, and it travels within your own MOS, it's going to be very difficult for her to go somewhere where that's not hanging over her head. Because, Cons, talk about what it's like whenever you have a pending either NJP, you have pending paperwork, you have a pending court-martial. Even if you're a staff NCO, they take you out of your platoon and put you usually in an administrative role.
Yeah, they remove you right away, and they make you start pushing paperwork, and they get you away from the fellow soldiers because they don't want you poisoning the well any further. Whether or not you end up being found innocent of the charge that you're being brought up on, it doesn't matter, because that scar, that scarlet letter, will always, as you mentioned, it's going to follow you no matter what. And it's just
when that charge come down, you might be innocent until proven guilty in court martial as well. You are not in the minds of the people that are working with you. You're like,
no.
Like, I'm not listening to this fucking staff and CO. They're a piece of shit, man. They're getting court-martialed.
All leadership capability.
I was wondering, in that year between waiting for the court-martial, did she still have to work with these soldiers? And now that she's been cleared? Did those soldiers still have to work with her? Like, how does that work? Does anyone know?
I would imagine they put her in, like, if she was in training, like, it sounded to me like she worked in the training office and was doing training stuff. They probably moved her into like the S1 shop, I would imagine.
Okay.
Usually it's kind of what happened, and they moved them out. But I would say without question, there's no chance that these soldiers who worked for her before are back under her chain of authority. Just no shot.
No, because they would have no respect for her whatsoever. And even if you would have to, I think, almost transfer her to another post altogether to get her away from anybody that has any notion of the story, because any sort of reputation like that, and it's going to completely, as I mentioned, erode her ability to lead efficiently.
Or her soldiers just sucked and she really got the shaft there. I don't know.
And I know Kate's going to hate this part, but I love calling fat people in uniform fat. Call it like it is. If you're a fat piece of shit and you're outside the standards, you are getting called fat by me all day long, because I'm not going to be sensitive about your issues. Now, if your issues come with a medical doctor's note, like, because I know that there's some depression medicines that carry along with it, weight gain is a side effect. But if you're just fat and you're eating honey buns, and I walk in and I'm doing a room inspection and you're eating honey buns, oh, buddy, you are getting called fat as that, a motherfucker.
That's one of my biggest things. I understand people put on weight, and some people are just naturally, their genetics lend them to be a bigger person. But if you're not making the effort to become a better individual and lose weight and be in better shape, and you're just eating honey buns, that's what annoys me to no end. I can get by if you're having a tough time losing weight, because losing weight is definitely difficult. But if you're making no effort, then I have no sympathy for you. And Chaps, although I might not call people fat, I'm with you in that. Like, hey, maybe we need, maybe we need to lose some weight. Maybe we need to look better in our uniform. I would probably do it a little softer.
Without the sound of your bleeding heart going into the mic, please share your opinion on the matter.
Last night at hot yoga, my muffin top came out and was overhanging over the top of my yoga pants. And I was so self-conscious.
I think that there's a large portion of the military community who, if you go straight to the heart of the issue, they respect that, like, and being told what their deficiency is, what a corrective action is. But if the Marine Corps ever gets to the point where we're hugging fat bodies and calling them like you're just a little overweight, we're in deep, deep trouble of losing deep-seated discipline.
Can I say, this just kind of reminds me, I was walking to the subway yesterday and a New York State trooper was parked next to the subway, and I watched him get out of his trooper car. I thought they had similar standards. This guy had to hold on to the roof of the car. I just stopped walking to the subway. I just stopped and turned and watched. It took him like 3 minutes to get out of it. He was, and I was like, what if some shit went down? Like, what?
Yeah, and that's the
thing.
He was older, so maybe
that's
the reason
why it's like that. Like, you can't say that you have to treat overweight people in the military with kid gloves. It's not a kid gloves job. Like, you are a detriment. At some point, you're so fat that you are a detriment to your unit, or could be.
Well, you're absolutely right. You got
to call those moments out.
No, I agree with you, because in the most simplest terms, our military is a fighting unit, and you cannot fight to the most effective ability if you are out of shape, and being overweight lends itself to being out of shape.
We'll stop.
Everybody's Vince Wilfork, where you could be still move with the quickness.
That would be amazing if that was the case. I will say, so outside of the military, you're beautiful. You do. I support you.
Yeah. Whatever, out of the military, be as fat as you want to, and I'll never call you fat. That's a problem unless you're Clem or Large on Podfathers. I will call them
Chaps fat. Will never run, and he will never call you fat, and he will also never plank.
That's true. I'll never plank, never run, never call anyone who's not Clem and Large on Podfathers fat. But it got me thinking, how badass would it be if there was a unit whose sole job was breaching? Like, and you can't do it with explosives, but you had nothing but huge defensive linemen who were like 300. Like, if you had, or offensive line, if you had like a Willie Colon, a squad rolls up to your house. It's Willie Colon, Vince Wilfork, J.J. Watt. You just have these huge human beings that are like, get out, motherfucker, or we are coming in. And that's their only job. They, yeah. Their fitness test is sprint for 40 meters. Other than that, you don't have to do it. And lift heavy shit. That's your mm-hmm. only job requirement. And then you just walk in. I think even if you have an AK-47 and a squad of like seven of those guys bust in the door, you immediately lay down your weapon and apologize.
Probably. Oh, yeah. What would you call that unit? What would that unit's nickname be?
The Punishers.
There you go.
The absolute unit.
That's way better than my
oh, that was good. Well done,
PFC Brent.
PFC Brent. Adorable. 5 points
to Gryffindor from Brent.
The wagon. Right. Maybe the
also, before we move on, we've kind of drawn this one out a little bit.
Yes, we have.
But I also love calling people nasty. I love it. When you're nasty, little fucking worm, that's the only thing that you can say about it. Bitch, yeah. Nasty. You are nasty a nasty worm. PFC Leonard, I've told the story about here where yes. I stripped him down into his tidy whities and told him that every time I see him in camouflage uniform, it reminds me of fraud, waste, and abuse because he was so nasty. He was just dirty and stunk to high hell. I think that that is completely fine. It's one thing if you've been fighting in a place like the Battle of Peleliu, like our good pal and longtime Stoolie Eugene.
I was like, if this isn't a transition to the next goddamn topic, I'm going to die.
It is. Round number two, the Battle of Peleliu. So one of my favorite aspects about the military is focusing on the history and legacy that defines us. Some of the battles are well known and some of the stories are well known. Most of the listeners even would know stories about like what happened on the beaches of Normandy or the flag raising of Iwo Jima. We've talked about that and the legacy that it created in the military, the Iwo Jima very specifically. I think that's the backbone of the Marine Corps in one story. Americans' history is littered with stories like this, with bravery, savagery a lot of times, and tales that are nearly impossible to imagine. So every so often, I want to do a little bit of Zero Blog history so we can get into some of these stories. One of these stories is the Battle of Peleliu. It happened at the end of February of 1944. The Allied forces had gained control of the Marshall Islands in the West Pacific and moved on to the Marianas, where 20,000 U.S. troops, by far the largest force in the Pacific operation, had put on Saipan on June 15. On the morning of September 15th, the 1st Marine Division landed on the southwest corner of Peleliu. Now back to where we were at a couple episodes on the Be My Little General. This is why when General Mattis said the people who have carried our colors before, that was the 1st Marine Division on the Battle of Peleliu. That's another allusion that we spoke of then. The U.S. forces had refined their amphibious strategy over a year of hard fighting, and by this time they had it down to a science. They bombarded the shit out of the Japanese and landed on targets before the troops came ashore. And when they landed there, they had the support of aircraft overhead, which, as you know, like any ground troop, if you have the air, you have the battlefield. The troops arrived on the shore in waves, gathering on islands and beaches until they had sufficient numbers to push inland. These methods had worked in earlier landings and were expected to work again on Peleliu.
Cakewalk. Easy peasy. I'm calling it. Not a history major, but I'm going to say we took the island in about 3 hours.
Wrong. The Japanese had learned from past attacks, and they took a new strategy aimed at bogging down our troops for days, inflicting mass casualties in hopes of pushing the Allies into negotiated peace.
Well, shit.
And Peleliu's many caves connected by networks and tunnels allowed the Japanese to hunker down and emerge mostly unscathed from this bombardment. The Marines turned north and began their advance, and they were targeted along the way by heavy artillery fire, shout out cons, and over the next 8 days, U.S. troops sustained about 50% casualties in some of the most vicious and costly fighting of the Pacific campaign. But you want to hear the real story and the real nitty-gritty of what it was actually like. Here from a World War II history documentary is Eugene Sledge, who has possibly the greatest nickname in the history of the armed forces, Eugene Sledgehammer. What a fucking name. Put him in the absolute unit with J.J. Watt and Wilfork and the boys. Eugene Slebs, although he's not a big fella, would fit in with a nickname like that. Here's Eugene.
One of the greatest fears I had was, would I be able to do my job? Because never having been under fire and never having been in the in the stress of combat, everybody goes through that. And that was the greatest fear you had at any time, was would you measure up in the eyes of your buddies? That was probably one of the greatest motivating factors to all of us. I think a great deal of it was based on the fact that it was so instilled in us that you can't let another Marine down. So consequently, you wanted to always measure up and do your best. The pre-landing bombardment had commenced. The din and the noise were so absolutely incredible, it's indescribable. You couldn't even yell to the man right next to you and have him hear you. I was absolutely scared to death, and so was everybody else. And the main thing that concerned me was I was afraid I was going to wet my pants. And yeah, I looked at the island, and all you could see, it was it just looked like a thin line. It was just a sheet of flame backed by just this huge black wall of smoke. And I thought, my God, none of us will ever get out of that place. All up and down the beach, shells were going off. Amtraks were getting hit on the beach before they could let the guys out. You could see guys falling all along the beach because of the extremely heavy small arms fire and artillery and waterfall. So we got in off the beach as far as we could go and hit the deck in the sand. And just before I hit the deck, I happened to look down, and my right foot missed no more than by 6 inches a Japanese mine that was in the form of a 500-pound bomb buried in the sand, and it had a metal pressure plate on the top of it. A little way down the beach, I saw a boy step on one, and it just atomized him. He just disappeared. The morning of the second day, our regiment, the 5th Marines, was ordered to take the airfield. So we started across on a trot, and the concussion from the Jap artillery shells was so loud and so constant that it was like as though the ground was swaying back and forth. And here you were up running through this, and you could hear the shrapnel go brrr, as big pieces, you know, would come growling by you. When we got to the other side, fortunately, we got up under some little bushes, and the Japs couldn't see us. We got out of the line of fire. I was shaking like a leaf, and I looked at one of the veterans, and one of the Guadalcanal veterans, and he was shaking as bad as I was. And he said, "That's a tough duty, Sledgehammer." He said, "I'd hate hell to have to do that every day." One of the things that the frontline infantrymen had to face was filth. Filth and fear went right together. By the third day, either you or your foxhole buddy told the other one he stunk. And of course, you both stunk from the terrible heat, the sweat, absolutely no way to get yourself cleaned up. And then in the tropics, when men were killed, say in the morning, by that night, they were beginning to bloat, and the odor was getting pretty bad. I felt that I would never get that stench of dead and rot and filth out of my nostrils. The Japanese had what was called infiltration down to a fine art, and they laid up in the caves, deep in the caves all night. So while we were attacking the caves all day, they were in a safe place getting rest. I think every man in my unit, except Snafu and I, at one time or another, was involved in hand-to-hand combat. And that's the most god-awful, primitive-sounding thing. It almost like I thought often it. That's the way Neanderthal man must have been. I mean, they'd get in the hole, you'd hear these ungodly grunts and curses and guttural sounds and so forth before the guy finally killed the Jap. And the Japs were incredibly aggressive. They were incredibly brave. My company landed with, K-35 landed at Peleliu with 235 men, and we had 64% casualties. The division was top-notch, one of the finest in World War II. I say the finest. And it was shot to pieces. The casualties higher than any division at Tarawa, as high as any division at Iwo. But I must admit that I learned how to survive there, as well as one could survive.
I mean, every aspect of World War II to me is unimaginable. Mm-hmm. When it really puts into perspective of having to sit there for hours and days in such a humid environment. And no, have you ever been to the Pacific Theater?
I have not, no.
I have not either, no.
Japan and the Philippines is ungodly humid during the June to September months. It is, I mean, you walk outside and it's like walking into a blanket where you feel like you can actually cut it with a literal knife and go down. You can't have a lot of carpets and shit like that in your house because they will get molded just because of the amount of humidity is the air. When you think about the, it's basically like Louisiana. When you have that type of humidity and dead bodies bloating and you haven't showered for days and you can't sleep because you're worried about getting killed, that type of situation is just, it's really unimaginable. I can't imagine going through it.
Yeah, and it was the highest casualty rate of any amphibious assault in American military history. Of the 28,000 Marines and infantry involved, 40% died or were wounded. So it just an incredible amount. And to think that island, when you're talking about the how our pre-bombing didn't work, that was our big plan, that island is basically is essentially a sponge. So the 10,000 Japanese just hunkered down in the little holes of the sponge, the rock-like sponge, and then they just popped back out when it was time. So just, ugh.
Well, I think that's important to mention. I think so oftentimes people just think that, oh, we figured out our enemies and then they just keep doing the same thing until we defeat them. And that's not the case. The enemies have intelligence officers too, and they figure out our strategies and they adapt and make it more difficult for us to accomplish our missions. So
as they say in Jurassic Park 2, they remember.
Exactly. Exactly. One of the comments, you know, that you think about going onto an island like this and that stood out to me was when he said one of your greatest challenges was worrying, would you measure up to your buddies? That's what he was worried about. He didn't necessarily care about, you know, the overall mission or what was going on in World War II as a whole, but it was like, am I going to be able to get it done for the guy to my left and to my right? And it's just so primitive in that regard, but it's just so noble that he was concerned about that.
Yeah, I think we put a lot of nobility on that. But there's also a lot of peer pressure and shame. Like if you put yourself in that, you just don't want to get back to Camp Pendleton after being with 1st Marine Division and being like, you know, fucking Eugene here. Guy's a puss.
Yeah.
Big old and puss.
Speaking of, if your name is Eugene Sledgehammer, you better bring the heat. You better fucking know.
Now, do we think he had that nickname from when he was 18, or do we think he got that nickname in combat or what?
What I like to imagine Eugene Sledgehammer is that he always batted cleanup in the lineup and he got it because he was an incredible baseball player. He was going deep and they're like, and Sledgehammer hits it deep into right field. It's going, gone. That's what I imagine him got his nickname. It's because he flung the Louisville Slugger around the old yard with the best of them. But listening to this, there is another clip that I have found of Eugene Sledgehammer from a different documentary. And this bad boy really puts into perspective how different World War II. Listen to Eugene talk about war trophies, because if you are serving now, this is so far beyond anything that we could ever dream of. Mm-hmm. Listen to this shit.
Officers tried to discourage the taking of any part of enemy bodies for souvenirs. But most Japanese soldiers had one or more gold crown teeth, and they just simply made souvenirs that were too tempting to Marines. And so I distinctly remember one night a discussion in the tent among the Peleliu veterans about the possibility of scalps. But you couldn't take Japanese scalps because they had a crew cut. So that idea was abandoned. Skulls were another favorite souvenir, but they were a little more difficult for us to take because we were on the move, and they were, unless you could get them and take them back to the rear and then boil them in a big pot and then clean the brains out and squirt a hose in there, something like that.
Buddy, we're talking about boiling skulls.
Like, yeah, boiling skulls and scalps.
Racist. Like it's a fucking deer.
Yeah.
I mean.
Like, oh, we wanted to take scalps, but they had a shaved head, so we couldn't. So we figured out something
those
else.
Those damn crew cuts.
Are you kidding me? Yeah. You know, now obviously, Chaps, as you mentioned, you know, Geneva Convention kind of frowns on us taking scalps and boiling skulls. So you
won't
really.
One of the Marines that I was with got in trouble for taking a candle. Like, a little different.
You know what? And then the other crazy thing that stood out to me in that second clip there was how he talked about the majority of his unit was engaged in hand-to-hand combat at some point. That
and
is
the
just,
sound. Like whenever you talk about the sound, we've said many times that the most terrifying command to get is not about face, but fixed bayonets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And can I just note too, I feel like we look at that generation and a lot of, I've seen people say, well, those generations were tougher. They're not like, look at these people now saying PTSD, blah, blah, blah. I just found this excerpt where it says, once an avid hunter, Sledge gave up his hobby. He found that he could not endure the thought of wounding a bird and said that killing a deer felt like shooting a cow in a pasture. His father found him weeping after a dove hunt where Sledge had to kill a wounded dove, and in the ensuing conversations told his father he could never endure seeing any more suffering. So it's not just this span. Yeah. So
that's the thing. It happened. It's just they didn't talk about it. That's the only difference.
And I think that they did talk about it. And if they didn't talk about it, that's why the World War II statistics for suicide are so greatly underreported, because the families were so embarrassed of what happened. Like if you had somebody that came back from World War II and killed themselves, they underreported big time. I mean, one of the most memorable interviews that I think that we've done on Zero Block 30 was Stanley Rubin. Mm-hmm. And when we asked him directly, do you think you have PTSD? And he said, no, I think I just have night terrors and I haven't been able to sleep since 1940. Like,
right.
Pretty crazy.
These people have gone damn near 70 years at this point with these terrible, terrible memories. I'm thinking from 1945 to when did we talk to him in 2016? Mm-hmm. I mean, just terrible, terrible, terrible. But at the same time, when you talk about taking trophies and you can't take somebody's scalp because they have a crew cut, gives me
it gives me a boner. Yeah, I mean, not to be gross, but the reason being is there's not no way to like grab the skull. There's nothing to hold on to steady the skull to get that scalp.
And I don't even think our military would be so desensitized to that level of violence that even if the commanding officers now said you are cleared hot to take a scalp, I don't even think most of the people, because we didn't see bloodshed like they did either.
No.
We're talking about 50% of our unit, but when you're talking EWO and places like that, it was 90%, 95% of the enemy forces. There's bodies everywhere. So seeing that level of death and destruction is not something that modern forces know about at all.
No.
Also, I'm just so lazy. I'd be like, are you sure we can't just dip out now? We got to do this extra shit.
Yeah.
I don't know.
All right. We'll reset and we will go on to round number 3. There's a bunch of female firsts that are taking place, not just in the Marine Corps, but all over the military. Catherine, you want to walk us through some of those?
Yes, Major Rachel Winecki has completed a major milestone in the F-35's Joint Strike Fighter. So that's our new fancy pants, pricey jet that everybody's been talking about.
The
F-35. Oh, yeah. So I think we're in the trillions of dollars with it now as we develop it. But Major Winecki has flown the A-10C Thunderbolt II and the F-16 Fighting Falcon on various missions. And she's now part of a team overseeing the development and testing of the F-35. And that began last month at, Joint Base Edwards. Her background in the A-10 Thunderbolt is one of the reasons she was selected for the job. She'd previously flown A-10 missions in the Middle East, Eastern Europe, and the Pacific. And FYI, the A-10 Thunderbolt is essentially a flying gun designed to provide close air support to troops on the ground.
If Calling you like it, watching people get blown the fuck up and completely destroyed to shreds, go on YouTube and look at A-10 gun runs. And the term pink mist, I think, is mainly about these A-10s, because they are insane, and you don't get to be a test pilot by being shitty. So she was probably really, really good at it.
She's a badass. She probably saved a lot of asses. I mean, I'm just saying here. Who knows? But I'm gonna call it. She's a badass. But yeah, she was selected to become an F-35 test pilot because, like you said, chaps, her exceptional flying ability, and that's what it was. Didn't matter, man, woman, whatever. She's just fucking good at flying planes. And now they're trusting her with this like $1 trillion one. And we were talking about like, can you imagine putting one of us in the seat and us being like, yeah, the seats are not comfortable. I don't like the way this
had one like massager seats or something like that. Yeah. Or really good stereo. Like, can you put Bose in here? Can you do?
If you're listening, let us come test the F-35. We'll tell you what really needs
low down. Yeah. I mean, it stands to reason though that, you know, she's such a good A-10 pilot, and they're talking about replacing the F-35 with the, or excuse me, the A-10 with the F-35. But there's some people saying that's apples to orange comparison. So I don't know if it'll actually happen, but it's kind of crazy with the whole F-35 program, how they're, it seems as though they're trying to justify it any way they can, and they want to replace the A-10. But then you have some people saying, well, they don't exactly do the same thing. So overall, that's just kind of a side note, but very interesting nonetheless.
Yeah. And I think it's cool. It's such a, like a highly technical, you got to be the best of the best to be like a tester and help, because they're trusting you with so much money and so much equipment. And she said that more women are coming to the test field and said, I'm grateful for the women who have broken barriers previously. They built the path. I look forward to the day when sorties like this are a regular occurrence. And I think they will be.
She's great. I mean, it really is impressive. And she's doing a valuable service to the Air Force. So
we're number one. Men are stupid. We're number one. Men are stupid.
All right. Well, that's enough of
enough of that.
Good story. Anyway.
Oh, wait a minute. You fools. You thought we were done? You thought we were done talking lady stuff?
Yes.
We did, but.
Well, guess what? We're not. Because also, the first female Marine graduated on Tuesday from the Corps' arduous and physically demanding Winter Mountain Leaders Course. The course hones Marine skills in cold weather survival, skiing, snow mobility, and mountain warfare. Sergeant Tara Lynn Baker, by the way, I just want to say, I love that her name is, she's like this badass sergeant. Her name's Tara Lynn Baker. It just sounds like a country singer. Like, I love it.
It does.
Anyways,
sound like a country singer, yeah.
A heavy equipment mechanic graduated from the nearly 6-week school based out of the Marine Corps Mountain Warfare Training Center in Bridgeport, California. You learn how to survive. You learn how to deal with the cold, she said. And she also suffered frostbite and hypothermia while she was there. The Corps has been pushing to train the force in extreme cold weather environments and recently doubled the size of their rotations to Norway to nearly 700 Marines in an effort to train more Marines in the harsh, cold Arctic. Holy shit, we're taking the North Pole soon. I'm calling it.
I think the biggest bullshit about this, whenever you have stories of women doing first thing for the first time, is that predominantly in the Marine Corps community, you have these fucking dickheads that need to show how big their fucking cock are because women can't do what they did. But when a woman does accomplish it, they still try to make it look like it wasn't that impressive. For instance, in the Marine Corps Times Facebook page, whenever this article was posted, it wasn't congrats, devil dog. I'm glad to see a fellow Marine do something great. They went on and they made comments because their dicks are small. They said things like, no one patted me on the back when I did this, so much for equality. Yes, they did, dude. When you graduated from a course like this, a difficult course that takes 6 weeks, you get patted on the back with a graduation certificate with a job well done. And not just that. How much did they lower the standards so that they could pass? Just because a female did it doesn't mean that your standards were so much higher. She did it. She should get praised for it. As long as this first shit goes on, males will laugh at you. Not necessarily true. And if that is the case, when you're the first person to do anything across the board, whether you're Jackie Robinson, whatever, you get praised for being the first person. The stones that it takes to go out and complete a course like this when nobody has done it, that's your gender, is pretty fucking impressive. And for male Marines that, and this is probably a minority, but the people who have to feel like they have to log in to do that type of thing, it's bullshit. There's no reason to take anything away from accomplishment like this, like flying the F-35. Grow the fuck up, dude, Marines.
You know what I think is also important to point out? When you are the first female to graduate from this course, that's a little daunting when you start the course knowing no female has ever completed this course. So if I can get it done, I'll be the first. That's got to be a little scary knowing that no female has tread in those tracks before.
It's also always scary when you see, I think you can be pretty isolated as a woman. Like, at least when I first got to the fleet and stuff, you are considered like separate. And so you live online a little bit. Like, I know I was on Facebook all the time, just trying to connect to people back home and feel like I wasn't alone. And if this is the kind of shit you see, and like looking up the guys who wrote this, they're Marines. And like, I just remember being in and walking through the chow hall and feeling like all these people like don't see me as a Marine. All these people, like some people have thicker skin. At the time I didn't. And it makes things so like, I just
when you elevate to something like this, it's even worse. Like, what do I have to do? You know, right. I think that's the thing that really pisses me off, because Marines should be about supporting each other and making everybody as lethal as absolutely possible. And when you have somebody that goes through a course like this and you're still continuing to shit on them, it's like, what the fuck do they have to do to be accepted by you? And if you're the kind of person that says you're not going to be as good as me, my guess is that you didn't do shit anyways. Let's move on to the next round. Round number four, the Army and Marine Corps are looking at what troops will need to fight in mega cities like Paris, Berlin, any of those huge cities that have massive
Atlantic
buildings.
City.
Chicago, shout out Atlantic City. Can you imagine fighting in the shitty area of Detroit, like going through all those old abandoned, huge, towering towers?
Yes. Well, lucky for you chaps, the Army and Marines got together and they've been doing some war games. To figure out what it would be like to fight in these mega cities. And
Call of Duty. Nice.
And this is a mouthful here, but there's a working group. It's the U.S. Army Subterranean and Dense Urban Environment Material Developer Community of Practice. I swear to God, I didn't make that up.
They need to fire whoever came up with
that. The acronym for that is USASDUMDOC.
Much easier. USASDUMDOC. USASDUMDOC, yep.
Yep.
And basically, you know, people say, well, what the heck? We already do fight in urban environments. An urban environment in a third world country is not the same as a Paris, a Chicago. And there are considerations that you have to take into practice when you're
fighting. Like, where are we going to get the best hot dog while we're here fighting?
Exactly. I mean, one of the examples that came to mind for me, I think about when I was attached to a light cavalry unit and we shot mortars. Mortars you can pick up and carry wherever. But when I shot mortars in Iraq, there weren't tall skyscrapers to contend with. So unless I'm just shooting it straight down Fifth Avenue, I have to figure out how the hell I'm going to shoot mortars, or if I can even use mortars in a city like New York or Paris or Chicago. And the part of this war game was also, all right, when we can't use conventional weapons, how do we then implement new technology to aid us in fighting? And one of the ones that stood out to me that I thought was pretty cool was there's technology, and this seems like it's straight out of Mission Impossible. There's technology you can attach something to the exterior of a building and know what the interior looks like. So basically, in a nutshell, we take what we already know about we're fighting in an urban environment and then ramp that up to fight in a more modern urban environment.
I mean, could you imagine if you were tasked with going in, if something happened, for instance, and there was the Empire State Building was taken over, and they're like, okay, guys, go clear the Empire State Building.
You know you can't use the elevators.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I wonder if you just say screw it and you don't even attempt to clear it, because how are you going to clear 100 floors?
I already figured that one out. Just saying.
How are we doing it?
All you have to do is
secure it. Tactical.
Yes, you secure the first floor and then you starve them out.
There you go.
That works.
Just wait and game. Let them enjoy it. I'm not going up those stairs in full gear.
But I mean, this is like some like futuristic movie type shit, because none of us would sit here today and think, oh, we better start preparing for the battles that are going to happen in these major cities now.
But in all reality, I don't think we're at the point now where we're letting people into cities. I mean, this is a real life example. Think of what Aleppo used to look like before the Syrian war. Mm-hmm. That was a nice city. It had huge modern buildings.
True.
Now it looks like it's in the middle of Afghanistan. Like, it just looks like shit. The modern military will never send people in without aerial bombardment and artillery shelling the shit out of somewhere before we go in.
Well, that's the thing you have to consider too. In part of this study was, how do we use our modern aerial technology and modern artillery without destroying the infrastructure like gas and power? Because you also have the civilian consideration. It's pretty wild. So I was just curious what cities you guys think would be the hardest to fight a battle in.
That's a great question. Hey, let's narrow it down. It has got to be U.S. city.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not good at geography.
mine would probably be New Orleans.
I swear to you, I was thinking New Orleans too, because of all the swamps and shit and the bugs and the heat and the humidity.
Mm-hmm. The weather definitely would play a huge part. Minneapolis during the wintertime.
Yeah. Two come to mind for me. Obviously, New York, obviously the density of all the buildings, but then also you got to contend with the subway system. And you think about like the caves that we had to deal with when fighting in Vietnam, and that's just ramped up even tenfold with all these subways that we have in New York City. And then the other one would be San Francisco because of the terrain. So you got the major buildings to deal with, but then in all the hills. So I think that would be extremely difficult.
That would be a huge pain in the ass. I feel like LA, they'd be like, ugh, fine, we're on your side now. Let us keep our mansions. Like, I feel like they just flip really quickly.
Yeah.
San Francisco, there's a lot of poop, like landmines all over the place.
That's true.
Gotta human be aware poop. Of those.
Yeah.
Human poop. All right, let's move into a little bit of save rounds and alibis. Anybody have any?
I feel like it's necessary that we give Catherine a safety brief for her trip to New Orleans this week.
The next time you guys hear from me, I'll have gotten off the plane from a 5 a.m. flight after a night of boozing.
Yeah.
The first thing I'm doing is coming here to record, so I'm excited.
If you get off and you make both flights, we've given you an NJP, meritorious mass. If you do both, you get the first ever ZBT meritorious mass.
All right, I'm down.
All right, so Kate, if I were putting my commander's hat back on and you were getting a safety brief, number one, don't be stupid. It's that simple. So you got to ask yourself, what would Cons and Chaps say if I did what I'm about to do?
I feel like you'd be all for it if you had a couple hurricanes.
Okay, that brings me to my next point.
Can I tell you best case scenario?
Yeah.
The Eagles win. Mm-hmm. We go out on, we're like being dumb tourists on Bourbon Street. This sexy Cajun man's like, bum, 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 and I'm like, yes, please. Next thing you know, we're back in his place. I'm on his bed like a little beignet, and he's just sprinkling me with powdered sugar. And we're just having ourselves a
I hope that's what happens.
I hope so, too.
Kate, I was offered you instead of like Derek Jeter used to offer the gift bags to the ladies that he banged. It's just like a bag full of alligator teeth.
And you know how Derek Jeter used, they said he used to watch highlights of himself while he was getting a blowy?
Yeah.
I'm going to be listening to my podcast highlights.
Perfect.
Hell yeah.
Yeah.
I was going to say, Kate, also, I would set yourself conservatively a 2 hurricane per day limit, because I think any more than that and you're going to get yourself in situations that you don't necessarily want to be in.
It's just the sugar, not even the booze. Yeah. Just so much sugar.
The hangover will just cripple you. Mm-hmm. And then lastly, if you do get in trouble, I'll chaps first.
I think I'll just get everybody on Zoom. I'll pull you all up at once.
If you get in trouble, just open up your Venmo on Twitter. I think you'll be fine.
Yeah.
But my actual safety brief is going to be one that I used to love to give to my Marines. We're actually going to play that as a retreat. Here's my safety brief for young Catherine as she goes. All right, take a second.
Hey, Gus. Sorry. I didn't know Gus was in there.
Yeah, he's hanging out today.
Hey, little buddy.
Emotional.
He's the best. Ah, oh, he's so paddable.
Yes. He's very upset about the green belt.
I know, dude. You have to let us know what they're... Can you call the township and ask what they're putting in?
Apartments.
Oh, fuck. That's like the worst case scenario, dude.
I know, dude. But my only thing, they stopped short of my fence. They went like 3 neighbors to the left where they stopped their clearing. What I'm hoping is that that's where that crazy wasp nest was. Hopefully it took out that wasp nest, and then I'll put in a pool.